When I was a little kid, one of my favorite movies was Robin Hood, the 1973 Disney version, you know, the cartoon one where they're all animals. It's a classic.
Robin, I was just wondering, are we good guys or bad guys? You know, I mean, are robbing the rich to feed the poor?
Rob? That's a naughty word. We never rob. We just sort of borrow a bit from those who can afford it.
Anyway, being a young boy, the notion of taking from the rich to give to the poor seemed more than noble. It seemed perfectly fair and even necessary. But my worldview back then was, you know, that of a child, pretty simple. The rich and powerful were like Prince John. They were just jerks who didn't care about anyone else but themselves. But as I grew up, I learned that the world was obviously way more complex, and what it means to be rich and powerful in today's world goes beyond simply stealing gold from the castle safe. Robin Hood kind of oversimplifies things. We live in a globally connected society where corporations and governments stand in for the crown and shareholders, CEOs, and politicians, some of which are autocratic, stand in for the Prince Johns of the world. And running around trying to steal from them raises a lot of ethical and moral questions, also possibly some jail time. But, you know, regardless, this film definitely shaped my childhood and how I view the world, and it makes me wonder, especially when it comes to cybercrime and hacktivism, what is the ethical line? In the last episode, we talked about a hack conducted by a South American hacker group named Guacamaya. They view themselves much like modern-day Robin Hoods, fighting to bring down the tyranny of oppressive multinational corporations and corrupt governments. So, who are they? What do they stand for? And more importantly, when it comes to hacktivism, does ethics have anything to do with it? This is Cloak and Dagger, a podcast about OSINT, technology, and global conflict. I'm MJ Benias. This podcast is powered by Sapper Labs Group. For more, visit www.sapperlabs.com.
And when it comes to hackers, you know, different people have different perspectives on what criminal activity actually means. The old one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist type of thing. And so what Guacamaya did was make this material available in a way that is just really hard to sort of refute. Even though it's going to take time for it all to, the full scope and scale to really be learned, could take months or years. It's just such a service that they performed in that way.
I want to begin by stating up front that we at Cloak and Dagger remain impartial when it comes to reporting on hacktivism and groups like Guacamaya. What matters to our team is how these groups shape our understanding of information security, how they alter our feelings about right and wrong in this arena. Anyway, let's dive in.
So my name is AJ Vicens. I'm a reporter with CyberScoop. I cover state-aligned threats and cybercrime, and I just spend most of my days either writing about, thinking about, or trying to talk to, and talking to sometimes, cyber criminals.
AJ has a lot of experience dealing with this culture of hacking and hacktivism.
Well, so I used to work for many years for Mother Jones Magazine, a national sort of political investigative reporting newsroom in the U.S. And I covered all sorts of things, but during the 2016 election, I covered the hackers that were sort of playing games with, what we've come to learn was a quite extensive Russian government interference operation. And as part of that, I interacted with this persona Guccifer. Technically, it was Guccifer 2.0, because there had been a previous hacker that went by the name of Guccifer, who had hacked the email boxes of prominent people and leaked emails. The name Guccifer 2.0 was clearly a play on that.
Right. The first Guccifer 1.0, I guess. He was a Romanian hacker named Marcel Lahel-Lazar. Back in 2012 and 2013, he was hacking into a whole bunch of accounts connected to celebrities and senators and other politicians, including the president, George W. Bush, and he would leak the contents of all those accounts. That's a whole other story, but he got busted and is currently in prison.
So Guccifer 2.0, this persona was posing as a hacktivist that just wanted to expose information about the corruption in the American political system. They were active on Twitter. They set up a WordPress blog, and they would post messages and say they had documents or emails or this or that. They were active on Twitter. They had open DMs, and so you could slide into the DMs and say hi. Let's chat. So, you know, like other reporters, I did the same thing.
Guccifer got into the Democratic National Committee's servers and began extracting a whole bunch of sensitive information back in 2016, mainly internal emails and communications. The big scoop was Hillary Clinton's emails, which, if you were living under a rock, made a lot of news headlines.
Good morning, Cecilia.
Robin, good morning to you. The Clinton campaign calls this a crime reminiscent of Watergate, but worse, more than 1,900 emails released just this weekend. We are talking about a slow leak every day, a new batch. And the Clinton campaign knows this could be a problem for them every day until Election Day.
It was an embarrassment. The DNC had to apologize to Bernie Sanders for some of the nasty things they wrote about him internally, with some Democratic Party staffers trying to figure out a way to slow down his campaign so Clinton would be chosen to represent the party. A whole bunch of donor information was also stolen, including credit card numbers and social security numbers, and a lot of people think that this leak of Clinton's emails was one of the key reasons as to why she lost to Donald Trump back in 2016. It was a wild ride. I mean, even Pizzagate was born out of this leak.
Weekend, as people were dining inside here, a 28-year-old man turned up armed with an assault rifle to, as he put it, self-investigate what police have called a fictitious online conspiracy theory.
The man fired a shot inside the restaurant. No one was hurt, but this became an alarming consequence of a growing online phenomena, fake news.
That was the conspiracy that Democrats were involved in the sex trafficking of children run out of the basement of Comet Ping Pong, a pizza restaurant in D.C. But there was something generally fishy going on, and Guccifer 2.0 was even fishier.
One of the original interviews with Vice, they used language that sort of made it clear that they weren't a native English speaker. They were trying to pose as, I believe it was Polish. I could be wrong on that, but they were taking Russian and translating it into Polish and then translating that. And Vice did a great job of pointing out the inconsistencies there early on. So it was kind of clear early that this was somebody trying to be something that they weren't. And so I would ask them questions over Twitter DM, like, you know, there's allegations you are connected to the Russian government. What do you say? They would respond with, "Oh, of course not. We're just hackers trying to make a difference." And they would send GIFs and little things. They would offer customized data sets or data pulls from their collection, which we never took. But you know, they were very aggressive in courting reporters, and then as the Mueller investigation played out over the next couple of years, it became very clear that this was, in fact, a Russian military intelligence operation. And, you know, just kind of the high watermark of state-backed persona attempts over the last, you know, few years.
So Guccifer 2.0 was a fake hacktivist group. Does that make them fake-tivists? Factivists? I don't know. It would be kind of like the Sheriff of Nottingham saying that he's Robin Hood. And as it turned out, Guccifer 2.0 was a massive Russian operation designed to interfere with the U.S. election. In fact, in 2018, the U.S. government indicted these 12 Russian military intelligence agents who were working in a group known as Fancy Bear, and allegedly they were the ones responsible for the hack and being Guccifer 2.0.
This world of hacks and leaks and all of that sort of thing really caught my attention. It's a really it's a space that can really shape narratives and agendas, and you see a lot of effort and energy that goes into doing these things from both the state level and then also the private side of things. And every country has their own flavor of it. You know, the U.S. does stuff. The other major powers do things. The Canadian government does things. Everyone does stuff that's just really quite interesting. I love learning more and more.
And this intrigue into hacking and the leaking of sensitive data is how AJ eventually found Guacamaya.
There's an organization called Distributed Denial of Secrets that sort of hosts and posts data that's been hacked or leaked sort of in the public interest. They obtain data sets, or people come to them with data sets sometimes. You know, they don't do any hacking themselves. They're not a hacking organization. They're more journalistic than anything else. So Distributed Denial of Secrets, or DDoS Secrets, published a release that sort of flagged that this group had published 2 terabytes of mining company emails.
If you don't remember, we covered this hack in the last episode. Guacamaya hacked Solway Group. They're an investment firm that owned a nickel mine in Guatemala.
That's a phenomenal amount of data, and it really struck me. And as someone who covers hacking or hacking incidents, this would be on my radar anyway. But the fact that they had done this just really caught my eye. And this is the type of hack that really starts to communicate that they're doing this not for money, not for political aims. It's really more of a genuine hacktivist feel right off the bat. And I'm predisposed to being into that sort of thing. I really think it's an interesting form of protest in our modern era. So I went and looked into it. And they were posting the materials to a website called Enlace Hacktivista. And they have a page there, and they post their files. And, you know, pretty soon it became clear that they were a group worth paying attention to. And then over the course of last year, they ended up posting several releases, and in all, more than 20 terabytes of data that had to do with militaries, police, private corporations across Latin America, or with sort of a Latin American nexus. That was just, you couldn't help but be transfixed by what they were doing.
Remember in the last episode, one of their hacks revealed that the Colombian military was taking sales pitches for OSINT tools that could install phishing software onto someone's device, and that some of the targets of these tools were journalists and activists? And that was just like one little piece of this massive puzzle. The Guacamaya hacks comprised terabytes and terabytes of data from different Latin American countries. And, you know, when you dump a giant pile of data like that, it takes a really long time to sift through, but eventually journalists began to find some really dark, dark things.
I think it was 6 terabytes of Mexican military files. And that particular batch of files has done a lot. I mean, even as recently as we speak today, there was a long-running situation where the Mexican military and the Mexican government had been accused of being involved with, or at least aware of, the death of 43 college students in Mexico.
It's one of the most emblematic missing persons cases in modern Mexican history. The forced abduction and disappearance of 43 students from the Ayotzinapa Teachers College on September 26, 2014. Some, but not all, remains have been found. All 43 are presumed to have been killed.
The National Security Archive in the United States, using Guacamaya files, was able to sort of show the depth of involvement of the Mexican military in that situation.
The National Security Archive, it's a sort of government watchdog. They're a U.S.-based nonprofit that keeps tabs on governments via investigative journalism and freedom of information requests and basically sticking its nose into government business. So all these journalists are basically rooting through the Guacamaya leaks, and these documents from Mexico pop up, and they tie into this mass killing of college kids.
So back in 2014, there was the case when a group of students from a school were attacked by security forces and members of a criminal gang as they traveled in buses through the town of Iguala. At the end of all of this, 43 students were taken away and never seen again.
Yeah, so the Iguala mass kidnapping. It's one of those horrific situations where so many people are to blame for what happened, yet no one really knows what in fact did happen, or even has all the puzzle pieces as to how everything fits together. So there's this college in Guerrero, Mexico, called the Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College. And like a lot of colleges, kids there experience change. They learn about corruption and that the world isn't so squeaky clean, and ultimately it changes them. Anyway, this college has had a bit of a bad rap. It's been known for having some activist tendencies. They did this yearly thing where they would basically commandeer a bunch of local buses and drive to Mexico City to honor those killed in the 1968 Tlatelolco massacre. That is a whole other story. Regardless, it was an annual protest that this college and these college kids did. And sure, it annoyed the hell out of the local transportation companies, but the buses generally were returned to their owners after this yearly road trip. Anyway, on this trip in 2014, the buses were forced to stop when local police set up roadblocks. They even shot at the buses. According to the Mexican government, the students were arrested and taken into custody. This is where things get really murky. The government says the students were handed over to the Guerreros Unidos, a criminal cartel, by the local authorities under the order of Iguala's mayor. The students were then murdered by the cartel. In 2016, Iguala's mayor was arrested for his involvement in the incident. But...
almost from the beginning, questions were raised about the actions of the Mexican military and their involvement in all of this. And it's a situation that the families of the missing students and others sort of paid attention to for years. And over time, it became more clear that there was connections to the Mexican government, whether they either sort of went soft on the investigation or didn't quite reveal everything they knew, or their connections even, or more active participation. It's always been kind of murky. And these documents have gone a long way to sort of establishing those connections in a very real way.
Several documents in the leak indicate the members of the Mexican army may have been aware of the incident as it was occurring and did nothing to intervene. Witness testimony even places many of the students at the army base, where they were sent for interrogation prior to being shipped off to the cartel. The documents even have correspondence between high-ranking army officials, stating that if lawyers or investigators visit the army base, that any jail cells present on the base must be removed prior to the visit, and that if the army is ordered to excavate the area where these alleged interrogations took place, they will not allow the removal of the flooring. Jesus. But that isn't all. There are details concerning propaganda and disinformation campaigns to target the parents of the students, the UN investigators, and human rights lawyers. The leak even shows that the Mexican military was already monitoring this college well before 2014, calling the school, and I quote, a breeding ground for subversives, all the way back in 2006.
The records reveal that Mexico's National Defense Ministry worked to shield the institution from civilian scrutiny during the investigation. And so if you just sort of think about that, I mean, here you have 43 college students killed, disappeared, put into a mass grave. Questions about the role of the your national military in this operation, and the police, and the sort of the some of the corruption issues, and just as families, you know, you can only imagine what that's like as a parent, or a brother or sister or whatever, and just not having the full answers. And so, any little bit that can help fill in some of those gaps has got to be just incredibly profound. And so, you know, it's quite remarkable what was inside these files.
Now, we still don't have all the answers in this case, but activists, journalists, and human rights advocates are still digging into it. I have to note here that the Mexican government and the military deny any wrongdoing. But the Guacamaya hack does go beyond the Iguala kidnappings.
Over the recent weeks, we've seen stuff about the Mexican military's use of the Israeli surveillance platform Pegasus on journalists and activists. We've seen this proof of surveillance of feminist groups by the Mexican military dating back to 2017. We've seen proof or indications of joint intelligence operations by the U.S. counter-narcotics and intelligence apparatus and the Mexican military, something the Mexican president has denied having occurred. These files contain just troves of information that's really hard to get through the normal either reporting or records request process in many of these places. And also, I should say, certainly when we're talking about Latin American countries and South America, places where questioning the government or standing up to militaries and police is not always the best idea, especially for a journalist, you know, it goes without saying that journalists in Mexico are some of the more brave journalists there are in the world.
I want to dive into the ethics of this. What's the ethical dilemma here?
Well, certainly, I mean, I think we can start with the fact that you know, this is a crime to break into somebody else's computer system and steal files. Like, just full stop, it's a crime. It's illegal under multiple laws. In the U.S., we have strong federal laws against this. State laws, there's a variety of laws in unauthorized access to computer systems is a very serious crime. I'm sure there are equivalent laws in most countries around the world. So full stop, it is criminal activity. But, you know, in terms of the ethics of it, that gets, to some degree, that's a matter of perspective. You know, and just because they do one sort of righteous hack, depending on your perspective, maybe the next one they do isn't so righteous. And, you know, this, you can't really say it's all one or the other. It's a gray area. I sort of see it as, and they've characterized it as a form of standing up to oppressive systems. And this is their way of standing up to oppressive systems. Extractivist, you know, when you think about their hacks on mining companies, for instance, these are companies that, in their view, destroy the environment, destroy communities, take advantage of people, bribe officials, organize with police to conduct surveillance of activists standing up against mining. You know, how do you stand up against that when everything's aligned against you, when the power of the state and the corporations are aligned to standing against you?
Right, exactly. It's like we all have this itch to fight for what's right and fair, to stand up for those who can't for themselves. It's why Robin Hood is so compelling as a literary figure, and Guacamaya is no different. They're trying to build themselves into legends.
So with Guacamaya, every time they post a tranche of materials, they post a message alongside of it. They post poetry, they've posted music, but it's almost always a message.
This is actually pretty interesting. Just so you know, the music in the background here is actually from one of their video drops. AJ will fill you in.
The music they choose to pair with their videos that they publish as well. So they'll, you know, it'll be a computer terminal and they're typing in their commands to do their hacks. But underneath that is music. And this is music that sort of sends a message. And I asked them about their music, and they told me that it was a very sparse quote they gave me back, but a lot of care went into the music. The music has messages of standing up, of people power type stuff, of hacking the system, of that kind of thing. And then they pair that with these vivid illustrations that lots of bright colors, greens and reds, and you know, there's always the macaw, the guacamaya, the bird is always in there, like at a laptop or something.
All these videos and musical clips and poetry and the messages, the art they create is unique. It plays to indigenous themes and motifs, a sort of return to the natural world. I mean, it makes sense. Their entire MO points to an attempt to destabilize power systems, to stop corruption and the destruction of the environment. It's as if the message is more important than the hacking. It's funny, because AJ was told by some American intelligence analysts he knew that Guacamaya may be a state-sponsored group. So he flat-out asked the hackers about it.
And they said that it seemed to them like a desire to distract from their message. And it also reflected a sort of a disbelief, especially among Western observers, that normal people could pull this off.
Add to that the amount of time they take to craft those messages, all that art, and that their targets are typically involved in corruption. Like, I guess, does who they hack and their message line up? Does it show a pattern of ideology?
They seem to have a theme. They stick to their theme of going after powerful, oppressive forces, in their words. They talk about the vulnerabilities they've exploited. These aren't sort of super complicated hacks in the grand scheme of things. They've actually published videos of them doing their hacks. This isn't sort of the highest level, sort of apex state-backed hacker type stuff. It's not entry level, but it's not anything that would prevent a motivated sort of a hacker from doing, but it wouldn't take sort of, you know, the U.S. government or something. You know what I mean? That's something that on that level, the general consensus seems to be of the people that I talk to, that this is leans more towards the genuine side than the state-backed side.
Okay, so they may be legitimate, and even from an ethical standpoint, they exist in some gray area between right and wrong, fighting for a cause they, and frankly many, believe to be just. In short, their intentions may be good, but there's a saying about good intentions: the road to hell is paved with them. I know you wrote in one of your articles that there was some concern because in one of their leaks, I guess, nothing was redacted. So there was a bunch of names of, I think there were Colombian agents who are operating in Australia. And I think they were working on like drug cartel operations. You know, it was almost like collateral damage of dropping the bomb. That ordinance will have splash damage and it's going to cause harm in other ways, maybe.
I'm so glad you brought that up. That absolutely did happen. So in this case, there was some of these files ended up revealing the sort of ongoing counter-narcotics operations involving Latin American countries and the police forces, the Australian Federal Police. And the Australian Federal Police said that it both harmed their security and put people at risk. And that's a real problem. That's, you know, full stop. Another example of this in the story was I talked with a Peruvian journalist who said that, you know, who, by the way, was threatened by his government for reporting on these files. But he said that one of the frustrations they had as journalists there trying to cover this story was that they wanted the military to sort of acknowledge the authenticity of the data and also sort of talk more publicly about the fact that the data exposed, you know, Peruvian soldiers and other officials who were in a very dangerous position in countering narcotic activity and criminal activity there. And this, you know, some of these files get into very sensitive information. There was one example in the files of the locations of another military's surveillance operations along borders. You know, very technical, specific data that can sometimes, you know, let's face it, put people's lives at risk. And that's a real concern. And so I think if we're sort of asking about Guacamaya's role in that, they're the ones that release this information. Should they go through and redact or pull some of these things out? I mean, I guess that's, some people probably think that, you know, but there's grades to this, right? I mean, some people would say also they shouldn't be releasing this information at all. So I guess it's tough, but I think that's a very real critique of this approach. And I think that the response to that sort of critique over time has been that that's collateral sort of damage in the overall goal of exposing corruption and wrongdoing.
This is clearly something Robin Hood never had to deal with, the collateral damage to innocent people, like the partners, spouses, and children of these police officers and government agents being now put in harm's way because a criminal group or drug cartel can tie them to a specific operation. It's obviously far from perfect. But also, Guacamaya, well, they're not journalists, they're hackers. And not only that, it's not just one person or one cell of people. AJ and his team noticed that in Guacamaya's responses and messages to their queries, it seemed as though there were different authors, who all were Spanish-speaking, but there were differences in sort of regional dialects being represented.
It became clear that depending on the message, there are different pockets of people involved. And when I say pockets of people, that could be different persons, like single people, or that could be groups of people. And then I asked them about that, and they said that, yes, it is a collection of people with varied interests along a sort of a same theme of standing up to these people, these powerful institutions. We don't really know who they are, where they are.
And since we don't know, the mystery and legend of Guacamaya will continue. And more importantly, the public perception of all this, hacktivism and taking it to the man. You know, everyone loves a good Robin Hood character. Someone to fight for those who can't against impossible odds. So is this what Guacamaya is? Or is this just the creation of a legend? And all too soon, the group's true flaws will come out, and Sherwood Forest will become a little bit darker. You know, Guacamaya, if you're out there, I'd love to talk to you. Thank you very much to AJ Vicens for coming on the show. Links to his work can be found in the show notes. If you like the podcast, please click subscribe and give us a rating. And for more, visit www.cloakanddagger.blog. Thanks for listening. This is Cloak and Dagger. I'm MJ Benias, and see you next time.